Accession number 20885, Reel 5.
Tom Cook, Reel 5.
Right, well, there was a ship had been interned in Algeciras Harbour, a merchant ship, a small merchant ship, and every day our intelligence summary recorded it was there, and they showed you the position of any Spanish units, it's the usual thing. And what the Italians did was they converted that secretly into a base from which to launch their attacks. Because what they didn't realise, of course, the Italians had invented flippers. The things ducks had been using for millions of years, they suddenly invented flippers. Now, when one of these raids took place, one of the Italians had a problem. So he dumped his flippers and his goggles and his outfit and his tank and got onto the mole, the North Mole, and walked ashore. And he walked through the dockyard and walking along the seafront. And it was near fortress headquarters that the regiment, the Devonshire chap on duty, challenged him and caught him. It was well inland, this naval officer. And I don't think they questioned, obviously they questioned about what information they got from him. I wasn't in on that. But everybody assumed that they were coming off submarines, you see. The first one did, but thereafter they used the thing. And of course they had these motorised torpedoes they brought over to put the limpet mines on the ships. And of course Buster Crabbe, the filmer Buster Crabbe, made some brouhaha about this, but it didn't quite happen like that. Now, there's one thing I should mention in Gibraltar. Can I go back?
Certainly.
Right. When I was in Gibraltar, one of the visitors was General Sikorsky, the Polish commander. And when he was due to leave, I remember seeing him off in his briefcase attached to the wrist on his ADC. They went off, and they took off on a Catalina flying boat. And as a Catalina was taking off, it hit some obstruction in the rock and ripped it open and sank or started to sink. Anyhow, the rescue boats were there, so they rescued them. And I remember Sikorsky coming in, soaked, absolutely soaked. They'd just been straight back to Gibraltar. They were soaked in the water, they'd been soaked, and the briefcase attached them. Now, Crabbe used that in the film of Crabbe to rescue the briefcase. That was one of the things they made up. Now, of course, Sikorsky was subsequently killed in Gibraltar, taking off or landing, taking off in Gibraltar. And the chap who was flying was a wing commander, was a very experienced man. But nobody ever mentioned that previous business. I mean, they're both accidents, I'm sure, that I'm absolutely certain, despite the allegations against Churchill. I suppose it was a bit of a problem with Sikorsky, because I mean, he was Polish and he was looking after Poland. And we were trying to deal with the Russians, weren't we? So, yeah, I remember the Sikorsky business. the other thing, of course, in Gibraltar, we had exercise in the tunnels. Tunnelling was taking place, and all the soil and rock was dumped to extend the runway, of course, because the airfield was littered with aircraft who'd lost their undercarriage landing. You're coming, approaching about a thing about 6 feet above the water. I mean, I know it's tideless, but there was a little bit of a tide, and they're coming just to lift the wheels behind. And the other thing in Gibraltar, when I first went, the squadron was a Royal Air Force, had a flying boat squadron with several London flying boats, biplanes. And there was a gale in the May of 1942, and the whole lot sank. So we got Catalinas after that. Got Catalinas. Incidentally, there was a story about the Bismarck that it was a Catalina that spotted the Bismarck when he got lost. The pilot was actually an American ensign, because the Americans had only lent us these Catalinas, and they'd lent us crews to train with, and they'd still kept one or two Americans on board to guide them through procedures. And it's alleged that this chap who actually spotted the Bismarck was the American ensign. Name Smith? Why not? It's a good story. Back to Gibraltar, back in England. Well, I came back to UK on the Langstaffan Castle, and I was in charge of the deck, of one of the troop decks. And there were lots of foreigners on board, Poles, Czechs, Romanians, all sorts of people, who were being taken back to England. Well, the ship was awful. We had one corvette with us, which stood on its head in the water. The waves, the Atlantic rolls are awful. We were bad enough on Langstaffel Castle, but this little corvette kept disappearing under the waves and then coming back up again. Anyhow, one of our chaps, my chaps, was missing. We hunted all over. 3 days later, we found him hidden in one of the ventilators. He's alive, still alive, but hidden in the ventilator. Anyhow, so we get back to England, and anybody who was in the in a cabin was really hammered by the customs. They didn't bother with us down in the deck troop decks at all. And just as well, because I brought back a stalk of bananas, which were non-existent. Now I go back to Gibraltar again. One other thing. When I arrived at Gib, just a week before, they'd captured a French ship that had failed to stop. And they'd opened fire with the 9.2-inch guns and had cracked the bloody foundations of the gun. They had these nines. There's one of them still in Duxford, one of those 9.2-inch guns. How the hell they ever got them up there in the first place? Unbelievable. Anyhow, they had actually hit the ship and killed the captain, and the ship was brought in. And it was loaded with millions of eggs and 10,000 tons of bananas. And they laid on the dockside in the sun for ages when somebody tried to sort out the diplomatic mess involved. Whose was it? Was it war? No, we weren't at war. It went on. It was going on when I got there. There were loads of correspondence about it. In the end, I think God said to hell. So he took them all over. We used to get eggs served. You'd get 10 for breakfast and one would be good and the other 9 were bad. And then the bananas, they were awful. They're rotting away on the dockside. Oh, it was unbelievable. Oh, well. Anyhow, I got back to England and I landed at... when we landed in the Clyde, with this ship of ours that do 10 miles an hour flat out uphill, we had to wait for 2 days in a while and unloaded an American convoy. And the other thing is, of course, we're now at war with America. The troop ship was dry. The Langstaffen Castle was dry. Completely dry. And infuriating, really. All British troop ships were after that. So, we landed. We had to wait at in the Clyde, and then we embarked and got onto a train and went to back to the old barracks in Barrhead. And then they gave me disembarkation leave, and I went home on leave. Back to the barracks, waiting for my commissioning course, only to learn in due course that the ship carrying my papers had been sunk. So I was about 2 months there, but I was orderly corporal most of the time, so I was on my own practically. Then there were a few other officer cadets as well waiting for the posting. Some of them, I couldn't believe it, some of the really, really good chaps were failed. What they call their octo course, their pre-commissioning course. They failed. Went back to the RTU. Couldn't believe it. I don't know what the selection basis worked. But I never had to do that one where you guess questions and climb over barricades and anything. No, none of that rubbish for me. So eventually I was sent to Southend, to Bristol, to Clifton College, where the Service Corps cadet unit was. And I was there on what they call pre-op 2. You had to do 2 or 3 weeks pre-op 2 to pass driving tests and general knowledge, that sort of thing. And during which I scrubbed more floors and scrubbed more gas ovens and did all the dirty work. And then the whole op 2 moved to Southend. And all the cadets except us lot were given leave. We were kept out to do the dirty work and loading trucks up and off we went. Anyhow, so that was from Bristol then to Southend. And Southend was, all billeted in private houses, and I was on course 138, which is notorious for being the most obnoxious, obstreperous bunch of people. One of the chaps on my course, when you commit on a cadet, you see, you lost your rank. You didn't show your rank, you were still paid, but you wore a white band round your porridge cap. And one of the chaps with him was a chap called Cunningham Craig, and he'd been a staff sergeant major, a CSM in the Intelligence Corps. Gibraltar helped to break some of the German codes. He's going to be a Service Corps officer. Surprising. I think they were just commissioning him for something, anyhow. But there we are. We had to parade and march, and we, you know, about 30 of us in this house. And we had to keep the place clean. There were a couple of cleaners there, but we had to look after most of the stuff. And we used to pile down to a place to eat. There was a main dining room about 400 or 500 yards away. So we'd wander down there. We wouldn't march down, we'd just wander down. We had this course, training course of, you know, like lectures and parades and stupid things like standing in a tennis court shouting at somebody 100 yards away, left turn, right turn, doing this, you know, waving our fingers about to tell him which way to go. And I'd been through all this. I'm in the army, in the infantry anyhow. But bear in mind, there were very few infantrymen who went into the service corps anyhow. So then we eventually I was commissioned. Whilst I was in Southend, I was very lucky. I had a cousin who lived in Upminster, so I could go there for Sunday dinner with him and his wife and his mother-in-law, and had marvellous food, apple pie and roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. Different from the... But I always used to go to church on the Sunday morning before I caught the train to Upminster. It's on the direct line, you see. And I remember at the church service, they had that... I'd never heard that hymn before, O Valiant Heart, which has been taken out of the hymnal, of course, now, because it's too military. But it's just one thing that struck me. I used to stay behind. You'd go to church deliberately for that song. Interesting. And then eventually I took our current course. One of the friends of my cousin's was the widow of one of the directors. It's a complicated business. She was related to the people who made Smith's Crisps. And we went on a battle course to North Wales, Penman Mar. And it really was a battle course. You had to march 20 miles across country by compass, you know, climb up and down mountains and go through firing exercises. And this friend had sent me a box of Smith's Crisps, a big box of Smith's Crisps. And it was delivered to us at a village called Dinorick, a bit near Snowdon. This is miners' cottages, abandoned miners' cottages. And our food hadn't arrived. For some reason, our food fell down. So we each had, each section of us, about six or eight of us, had a little place with a room and a little place for storage. We got firewood together, got a fire going. So we got these crisps. We opened up our emergency packs and melted the chocolates and dipped the crisps in chocolate. And somebody got a box of cigars. So that was our battle course. Then the next day we had to go up Snowdon, up the railway. And it was bloody cold. It was cold. I went right to the top, and it, by the time I got to the top, there were about half of us left, you see. And it was really hard work climbing up that railway, I'll tell you. And the railway people got cocoa and tea ready for us. I think very nice of them. And then we came down, and at the bottom, they said, well, normally we'd stay here the night. But if you like, if you want to go the 21 miles back to Penman Mar, march, we'll do that, and then you have the day off tomorrow. This is more at the end of our week, you see. So we decided to walk. And there were trucks coming, picking up the sick, lame and lazy now and again, you see. And towards the end, I remember saying to our team leader, this captain, his name was, I said, well, the next bus that comes, I'm getting on it, I'm backed out. He said, I think we'll all get on. We all got on. We're the last 2 miles, we were taken by a truck. And then we had to walk a mile and a half for our food. But now we got the next day off to go to the and visit the sites, the Welsh sites, and then back to our base. And there were all sorts of exercises in trucks and how to drive vehicles and how to get them out of ditches and all these things we were taught. And most of what we forgot, of course. And then eventually we were commissioned. Now the funniest thing that happened on a commission is the day before commission, which was a Friday. The colonel sent for us and spoke to us. Only a young fella, the colonel. And he said, you can forget all we've taught you. All you've got to do is look after your men. That's all you've got to do. Forget everything else. He said, your sergeant and corporal to do all this. You look after your men. When I went downstairs, I was in my uniform. And they were very hot on uniforms. I had Simpsons, actually. I got a uniform allowance, which wasn't nearly enough. I spent the whole of my savings on uniforms and things. Didn't buy a sword, of course. But then... we were inspected by the regimental tailor, and if it wasn't good enough, the unit had to be remade. Fortunately, mine was fine. So I was in uniform with a pip on the shoulder, though I wasn't actually commissioned that day, and I went to the loo, the toilet, and I'm standing having a piddle, and somebody behind me said, morning, sir. Turned around and, Christ, a chap from Hodgson Harris & Co., 2 years older than me. He's just started. It was his first week. And that was Guy Hyam. Yeah, that was funny. Anyhow, there's a story attached to Guy Hyam too, later on. But so off I went to... the night before, I'd been invited to a nightclub in London, my first ever nightclub, by my cousin, Odonino, in Odonino's. My cousin was an RAF pilot, but he wasn't, because he'd been sent to Rhodesia on the Empire training scheme, and his first aeroplane had crashed. His second one had landed on top of two others, so they decided they couldn't afford it. So that was it. So there we are, back to washing aeroplane. Anyhow, then I went home on leave, travelled first class. Oh boy, that was something, first class. Anyhow, home on leave, and those guys, there's nobody left in Hull I knew. There were no, the service corps, East Yorkshire, everybody had gone. So it was a pretty quiet sort of time. Then I was posted to the Guards Armoured Division in near Warminster, Wiltshire. And I think that's a bit of Gort's doing, actually, to get me posted there. And then they hived off our brigade as a separate brigade, as a heavy tank brigade. Then we moved up to... by the way, in the March, I'd met the lassie who became my wife then. And a Hull girl, of course. And then we moved up to Newcastle, to Gosforth Park, stationed there. Then I was sent on a training course. By the way, I'd done training courses, like military, you know, battle courses and that sort of thing. I suppose being an ex-infantryman, they assumed I was ready for it. So I did this battle course in Devon, near Woolacombe Bay, Devon. And then exercise, you know, a transport course, officer's course in Sandbanks with the Guards Armoured. Bearing in mind that when I went on these courses, there were usually a couple of dozen Guards officers there as well. They're quite a weird sort of, you know, all the Guards like Percy of Northumberland, and there was one I do remember. And so you were quite mixing, quite a mixed bunch. Then anyhow, we went up to Newcastle, and then I was posted to a motorboat company, because somebody had found out, I don't know where, that I'd actually been on a trawler. And they said, ah, man for the motorboats, you see. So we're over establishment, you see. The Guards Armoured had too many officers. So I went to this motorboat company, but we had no motorboats. Our job was to deliver vehicles to the American Army. And what we would do from a place called Boddington Manor, near Cheltenham, we would take a bunch of men in a bus up to Aintree, where there was a big depot, pick up 20 or 30 trucks from the depot. Sometimes we stayed overnight with them, and that was a sight, because American officers had money galore. Poker scores with hundreds of pounds on the table. My little pittance. Oh well. And when you in the British Army, when you would collect a vehicle, every nut and screw and spanner was checked on and off in the kit, every wheel, every tie number. American Army, there you are, 10 trucks, help sign here. That was it. So, sign here. And then we deliver them mostly to Air Force bases in East Anglia.
So what's this got to do with motorboats?
Nothing. We didn't have any motorboats. We didn't have any motorboats, so that's what we did. I did that for 5 weeks. I forgot a flip on a Flying Fortress. There was even, at one time, you know, the Flying Fortresses would arrive. One time we arrived, and don't forget, I'm bringing trucks. They didn't have any transport. They used to fall on, wrap, put their arms around me for transport. Nothing. And I used to take a bottle of whiskey for the colonel, because they couldn't get it, you see. So, and now one time I went, we stayed overnight, because you know, we were quite a way away. Stayed overnight. One time I went, and they'd just arrived. The squadron had flown in the day before, and they were sleeping on the floor, and the meal was bully beef and biscuits, I tell you, in a bare echoing hall, British. Their stuff hadn't got into gear, you see. And they'd arrive, and if one of their, and once they got into training, if their one of their crew was ill, the plane couldn't take off. So the British volunteers, British officers were volunteering to go. How many went, I don't know, but that was the story. We actually got a flight on a fortress with a promise of a raid. They were bobbing the Scharnhorst and the eyes now and then. Because we know the only time we got anywhere near it was fog, and that was it. There was a story that one British officer had been shot down on his weekend pass. I mean, we got these lovely stories. Anyhow, so we delivered these vehicles to the Americans. One time I delivered, mostly to the Americans. One time I delivered them to, what's this place, the Atomic Centre down in the south?
Aldermaston?
Aldermaston, yes. It was a light bomber base then. I delivered some vehicles, and as I was delivering them, there were marauders were coming in, firing flares with wounded on board. You could see them coming in, it's a weird sight. And then I was about 5 weeks with this, delivering this thing, during which I managed to see my great school pal, who was a staff sergeant in the engineers at Cheltenham. The one whose 21st birthday party I'd cheated for. Then I went to, from Cheltenham, I was posted to a 516 company, I think 516 company, up near Bishop Auckland. And this was a more or less training organisation. I was supposed to go there and do training. And they were really training men to post overseas. It wasn't really a company, a training unit. Whilst I was there, the girl to which I was then engaged, had a friend in the village nearby, so I used to go over and see her fairly regularly, motorcycle over the hills towards Crook. Anyhow, then eventually this company, that's right, then I decided to get married. So I got my... before that, the company was then formally, solidified, I suppose is the word. It was then made into a proper transport unit. Instead of just being a training unit, all existing officers and personnel became a company, an active service company, field force unit, and were transferred to the overseas, what was going to be the 21 Army Group. And we moved down to Bradford. Before we moved to Bradford, we moved to Bishop Auckland proper from this little village where we were. And it was then I decided to get married. So I went off on a week's, 10 days' leave to get married. And whilst I was there, a posting came through for me. It was just before they changed over. And I wasn't available to post, so somebody else went off to Italy, I think. When I got back, it had been made into a permanent unit. So all the officers on the strength became the officers of the company, you see. Instead of just in transit, as we were. All of us, the whole of the company, except the company manager, were in transit for this unit. But anyhow, we then became a firm company. And we were moved down to Bradford. And Bradford were converted to 10-ton trucks, heavy trucks. British Army had never had anything bigger than 3 tons before, you see, except for artillery. So we were given these 10 tons. We were given 2 platoons of Albions, British made, which would do 28 miles an hour flat out, and 2 platoons of Whites, which are big American trucks, which were so... well, strangely built, that they had a huge pile of iron on the front, in front of the radiator, to keep it on the ground. Anyhow, so that was that. Before we collected these trucks, by the way, I was sent to take a convoy of vehicles down to the south coast, towards London, to London. And on the way down, we had to pass through Windsor Great Park. And we saw this flying fortress coming in, landing. Obviously, it must have been lost because they weren't supposed to have the area, coming in and crashing. And we sort of shot over and went over towards the plane to see what they could do. But of course, there were people around, but there were wounded and things in this fortress that crashed. Anyhow, we couldn't bother too much. I'd got the job to do, so I went off to deliver these vehicles, then back to Bradford. So then we're given these 10-tonners, and we're based at Bradford, near the Bradford Royal Infirmary. Manningham, which is not a very salubrious place now, I gather. Then February 1944, we were moved down to Walton-on-the-Naze, most dreadful journey. It bucketed with rain, sleet and hail. All the officers had to be on motorcycles. No question of sitting in cars, keeping warm. It was a dreadful day. And we eventually arrived in Walton-on-the-Naze, which, of course, was a centre point for the assembly of the German, of the American Air Force. They used to marshal themselves up there, you see, right above. So it was quite weird. I remember going to the church one day when there were two of us in the church service, and the parson and the choir boy, the altar boy, that was it. And above you could hear these 2,000 engines, building, vibrating. Oh, the strangest thing. And then they'd set off, and then half an hour later, along would come the thunderbolts and the lightnings, and then the alternates would join them. Anyhow, so that was Walton-on-the-Naze. Now, as I say, we were, by this time, a heavy transport company. And an unfortunate thing happened. We had my platoon, fortunately, was billeted just near the company headquarters, near the what had been the pier. But the other three platoons were based in a block of flats about half a mile down the road, and these were luxury flats, some of which had been kept furnished by the... There were some holiday flats, you see. Unfortunately, some of the lads found their way into these flats. And, of course, eventually, on Sunday, where all the officers were told, the sergeants were told to get ready. And my platoon, because they weren't involved, were marched down and surrounded the place. We had to inspect all the men and equipment, and the silly buggers had stolen silver spoons and teaspoons. Ah, stupid things! Well, it was a big thing, it was an enormous thing. So many men involved. And I thought, well, I can't believe mine. I can't believe mine aren't involved. So as soon as I got back, I had a search of mine. Didn't find anything. I mean, I had a bunch of right Charlies, I'll tell you. But there we are. And of course, the result of this, there was a court-martial and 10 or 12 of them went to the glass house. Bad business, a terrible place, the glass house. Terrible place. Oh. Anyhow, so that was that. And then we went off to... and then when that was over, and then I was detailed to go to collect 5.5-inch artillery shells and nitroglycerine. The nitro our job was to take these shells over, but the nitroglycerine was going to be used to demolish the positions to the top obstructed access, you see. And so I went after Stevenage, well, north of Stevenage. Which, remember those days, all the wooded areas were lined with ammunition dumps. Anyhow, Stevenage, and I was taken very ill. I was very, very ill. And I got tonsillitis and quinsies. But I didn't know. Anyhow, I hung on, and it was getting really fuzzy and messy. And then, of course, came D-Day. And on D-Day, I had no desire to leave. Things come out. On D-Day, actually, I was sent to... D-2, I didn't know it was D-2, I went down to back to Southampton because from Watton-on-the-Naze we were sent down to Southampton to unload Liberty ships because being 10 tonners we could get these big, and we were unloading these big tanks which joined together form rhino barges, and of course we had to convert the trucks, we'd take the lid tops off and make sections for them to carry the beams and the girders and find a way out of Southampton that was safe not to demolish telephone wires. One of my drivers did manage to rip half the telephone wires down, Goldberg, and he went into a mental hospital, actually. Well, an asylum. He was put into a mental hospital because he really wasn't right. Poor chap. Anyhow. And we're unloading these Liberty ships. And that was when I first saw these... all the America had coloured troops. They weren't fighters. They were administrative people. And they were driving these forklift trucks. Never seen them before. They fell asleep on the trucks. It was weird. And then we had a bit of a setter with the union because we wanted to work on a Saturday and they didn't. And a bit of difficulty one time. Anyhow, that was sorted out. And when we were unloading these Liberty ships, a lot of these were on one-way passages. The Benjamin Cotty, the first one loaded, were actually finished up as a block ship at Utah Beach. A brand new ship. And we got the impression that they're all going to, that was going to happen to all of these Liberty ships coming over. But when they packed these big tins, they wanted dunnage to keep the stuff from moving, and they put cigarettes in. Millions of cigarettes were stacking. And trays, breakfast, meal trays that the American Army used, you know, instead of mess dishes, they used this tray with set out different sections for food. And there were millions of those, and they were the lining of the ships to stop it vibrating, stop the things rattling. Cigarettes by the hundred, I mean... Any cigarettes you like, hundreds of them. Because we couldn't take them off the docks officially. The customs were very hot with us. Anyhow, so we loaded these four ships. And then there was an interesting occasion because I was orderly officer one day. We were living on a cricket pitch in Botley, near Southampton. And we ruined the cricket pitch. And we were the officer's mess, and the company headquarters... And obviously, mess was the pavilion, what had been the cricket pavilion. And one day there was the company football match final on, and my platoon was going to win because I had the best team. Well, we were all of us gathered round watching this match, and suddenly a chap came over from the gate and said, "Will you come to the?"